Hello and welcome to FOFOP. I'm Will Anderson. And look, fucking hell, today's been a bit of a day, to be honest. I'm in America. I'm in the United States of America. I'm in Los Angeles here in my apartment. I've spent no time in this year, but heaps of other people have spent time in, which means that this apartment now has heaps of other things in it that it didn't have when I was last here. I haven't been here since January, but a heap of my friends have stayed here. And over the time, it's accumulated leftover things. And I'm not sure necessarily who of the people who have stayed here have left the various things, but I have a whole bunch of new things. It was quite weird to get here. Anyway, as some of you may know if you listen to my other podcasts, welcome if you're a new listener. There's going to be a rambly intro to this. If you are a new listener and you don't want to listen to my rambly intro to this, or if you're an old listener and you don't want to listen to my rambly intro to this, I don't know, skip forward a bit, use your own, but there's going to be one. Anyway, if you're here for the first time, you might be because we have a really big special guest on the show today, and this is what I'm going to try to tell you. So anyway, I've got a bad back. I've had a bad back for about 2 months. It's some sort of nerve issue, and it's fine once I'm up and about, but lying down, sitting down, I haven't sat down for 2 months. It's fucking shit. It's shit. You miss sitting down. You just forget how much you sit down and how enjoyable things are when you sit down. Like standing up to have a meal or standing up to watch a movie is nowhere near as fun as sitting down to do those things. I'm avoiding traveling as much as I can. I'm overseas at the moment, so I had some things booked in that I didn't cancel. If I'd known how bad I was going to feel, I guess I probably would have cancelled them. But I was at the time hopeful that I was going to feel much better than I'm feeling right now by the time all these things came around, and some of them were quite important. I went to the Montreal Just for Last Festival. Thank you for those who came out. There was some real highs and there was a couple of real lows. I've been struggling a little with my mental health around my physical health. As people who suffer from chronic pain of any kind will know, that there is a link between you can probably hear my washing machine in the background. There can be a bit of a link between chronic pain and some dark times mentally. And I got to say, as I said, if I knew I was going to be in so much pain, maybe I wouldn't have committed to as many things as I was already committed to. And I thought that I could handle it all. And there was a couple of times where I think the combination of my pain and all the pills that I've been on for the pain, and just, you know, the high stress nature of an event like Montreal, where, there was an incident on the last night. I won't go into it too much. I won't bore you too much. But you ever had one of those nightmares where in your dream you're trying really urgently to get, like, do a school test or a university test or something really important, but no matter how hard you try in your dream, you can never get to that thing? I had that happen in, like, real life, and it's shit. And so then I cried in front of some people speaking French. Anyway, good times. Anyway, the whole reason that I'm here in the US this time is that we're actually pitching. I can't tell too much about what we're doing, but we're pitching some television, something that I'm really excited about, with some people that I'm really excited about. And this was the time that I could do it in my schedule. So anyway, today we went and we pitched with HBO. That was a really fun experience, you know, for a kid from a dairy farm. You know, my family live on the road they were born on. And, you know, I've had this great dream to do this as my job, and even to just, you know, sit in a meeting with people from HBO and have a conversation with them about your idea and have them ask you questions about the project and, you know, have the opportunity to explain to them why you think the thing that you want to do is unique and would be interesting to them, is regardless of whether, you know, these people have interest in actually making the show, because that would be terrifying in its own way. The opportunity to do this has been, you know, it's a really fun thing to do, and I really enjoy it. But the thing I do not enjoy is having to pretend that I can sit down in the meetings. So today we had a meeting with HBO, and luckily it was most of the people in the meeting were on a Skype call from New York, and so there were some in the meeting we were in. But basically, I managed to sneak into the meeting first, take the 15 minutes it takes me to sit down in a chair, and then pretend that I was not in serious pain and was actually completely casual, as I leaned casually on the table the whole time, then waited for everybody to go, for them to turn off the Skype, and then took the 15 minutes it takes for me to stand up. So anyway, I've got 3 meetings tomorrow, so that's going to be a bit of a challenge. But anyway, the reason I tell you this is that I got a message yesterday from a friend of mine from the Just for Last Festival, one of the producers there at the festival, who was like, hey, Joel McHale's coming out to Australia to do some shows in Australia and New Zealand. And I reckon he would like to come on your podcast. Is there any chance that you can do it, well, this afternoon as I speak to you? So anyway, I had this HBO pitch in the morning and that was going to be the only thing that I did that day. I walked to the pitch. It took me an hour to walk there and I walked back because walking is the best for my back, getting into like a cab or whatever. But I was like, well, I can't walk to John McHale's house where he was generous enough to invite me over to his home. I said, I can't walk there. It was too far away. In fact, you know, the front door of his house to the back door of his house was too far away. He had a very nice house. Anyway, so he invited me over to his house to have a chat to him. And I thought, well, you know what? I'm just going to put my back through the pain. The poor first cab driver I had, I warned him at the start. I said, it's okay, mate. I said, you know, but the truth is I just can't sit down properly. So like I try to find these positions to lay down where I can be in the least pain in the back of the cab. And this poor guy who was driving me over was having a nervous breakdown because he was just caring about me too much. He was generally just a nice guy. And he was like, he could see how much pain I was in. And I was like, I was trying to reassure him. I was like, no. It's okay, mate. It's terrible, but it's yeah, okay. Now my washing machine is beeping at me. So that definitely was my washing machine before. In fact, I don't even know why I'm saying it definitely was, because I knew it was definitely then. Like I've solved the mystery. Like this is law and order. What's that noise? Anyway, anyway, what's that noise? And every week they'd have a different noise. Anyway, why would you skip through this bit? It's so good. Anyway, I'm a little bit, look, I've had some edibles for my pain. Now, and I am also drinking a beer, which you're not actually meant to do, but Gareth Reynolds, the very funny Gareth Reynolds from the Dollop podcast and regular on this podcast, we did a new episode just a couple of episodes ago, you can check that out. Gareth Reynolds brought me over as a bit of a joke, a giant novelty-sized Foster's beer, and then I got home today and my back hurt so much that I needed to have a beer. So I had some of the medicinal edibles, and then I have drunk this beer that was bought as a joke, but I've actually quite enjoyed. Because we don't really drink Foster's in Australia. It's not really available, but it's actually not that bad. Anyway, the joke is that we just send it overseas with people, but I've quite enjoyed it. Anyway, all right, so this is the intro. John McHale, I wanted to do this intro because I wanted to explain, firstly, that John McHale's on the podcast. You know John McHale from The Soup and Community, which is one of the best shows of all time, and a whole bunch of other things that he's famous for. He was really nice. It was really nice to meet him. You know, he's a big star. And, you know, I kind of felt like by the end... Okay, so here's what I was going to say. Is his mic technique is terrible. But the truth is that when you get invited over to a big, like, Hollywood star's house and you have an hour with them, there's just a point where you just give up on trying to, you know, like lecture them on what their mic technique should be. So he often plays with the cord. There might be some static. There was giant periods of this interview where he just rested the microphone on his chest and then like kind of spoke over it so that his chin was kind of, his very good and solid jawline was definitely covering the top of the microphone. So I imagine it wasn't picking up much. Mike Hell, our super producer, has probably worked very, very hard on this episode and it probably sounds much better than it deserves to. But anyway, if there are any... see, I'm apologizing for something I imagine has happened rather than me having listened back to this and knowing that this is a problem. But anyway, here's what I'm going to guess. I guess there's probably some sound problems. But he was very generous and it was very nice. And he's doing some shows in Sydney. One of them is the same night as we're doing the live TOEFOP. So you can actually go and see Joel McHale's show earlier in the night and then come and see us at the live TOEFOP. I mean, to be honest, if you like this episode a lot, oh, here's an idea. Okay, now... I don't want you to harass a celebrity online. I certainly do not want you to do that. But here's what I would say is don't do it in some organized, horrible campaign way. But if you enjoy Joel on this, if he's in Sydney the night that we're doing the live TOEFOP and his show is finished by the time that the TOEFOP starts, and I guess if you really liked him on this podcast and then like messaged him afterwards and told him you really liked him on the podcast, he and then maybe like coming up to the podcast, I just hit him up and be like, hey, Joel, it was really good to have you on the podcast. I've noticed like there's a lot of, by the way, this is how I talk when I talk to him. I was like, there's a lot of good feedback online, man. Sorry, what am I doing? Anyway, don't mix your edibles with Foster's. That's the message. All right. You understand what I'm saying. Okay, check out our Patreon, our webpage, tofop.com. Tofop and Fofop on the Planet Broadcasting website. And we're loving being involved with those guys. You can listen to Charlie on the Weekly Planet, which is a brilliant podcast if you like comic books, comic book culture, movies, any of that sort of stuff. We really like those guys and we're proud and pleased to be working with them. I have a podcast called Willosophy, which is where I talk to people about what they think life is about. I did one recently with a very dear hero of mine, Tim Ferguson, who people might know from the Doug Anthony All-Stars. And I recently did one with a brilliant young comedian, writer, just a new voice on the scene, Bridget Fettesy, her name is. And if you are not familiar with her name, if you don't know her work, she has a really great podcast called Benched, but she's a really great, incisive, provocative writer and thinker. Really enjoyed doing that episode with her, so check that out as well. All right, this was the plugs. When's this going to go up? Okay, it's going to go up next weekend, so I've already been in Vermont, so I'm not going to plug that. Tofop is doing the LA Podfest. As well as doing two live shows at the Sydney Opera House, we are doing the LA Podcast Festival. Jackie Cation, Laura House, Graham Elwood, Dave Anthony, Gareth Reynolds, and Matt Kirshen. Huge lineup. How's that? That's such a good show. Anyway, we'll be doing the LA Podfest, so come and see us at that. All right, this is it. This is the bit you skipped. If you're skipping through, this is where you can stop. Stop, 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 stop now. Okay, John McCall.
The following episode of Fofop is classified MA. It contains some coarse language, some nudity, drug references, a sex scene, time travel, terrible Batman impersonations, a Charlie Clausen pronounced Clausen-shaped hole, and mild coarse language. Fofop advises that the program is not suitable for persons under the age of 15, and minors must be accompanied by an adult guardian or priest. This is John Deek speaking.
Have my back used to go out and I used to just be laid up for 2 days and I'd just be like, well, can't move, my back is completely destroyed, so I'm just gonna lie here. And then a trainer said, if it's your lower back, I'll fix you in 2 weeks, and she did.
What was the secret?
Deadlifts, strengthening all the lower back muscles.
Right.
And it's the complete opposite of what people say, which is lift with your legs, you lift with your back. And it started out with like 45 pounds, me just lifting a bar, straight legged. And and then I began building up and building up, and no back problems.
I mean, that's got to be the first time you pitch that to somebody as the system, though. It's got to be like, one of those things of going, I'm not sure. I know what you're saying, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, I was like, well, at that point, I was about to shoot this movie with Eric Bana, and I was like, I was doing all this action stuff, and my back was, I was always like very careful at the weight room because I knew I could fuck it up, and then she said, I'm going to fix it, and she did. Her name is Allie Gritz.
Well, that's one of those things where, like, I mean, getting, you know, when you have your body start to, like, break down, particularly if you are a person who is fit, because you seem to be like a dude who's into fitness, right? I used to have...
Seems like it, or yeah. It's very obvious that,
well, it's very obvious is what I was about to say.
That's right, Australia.
It's very obvious that you're into fitness. Like, I can see you, you're in sort of like, you know, a pair of sort of cargo short, you know, t-shirt.
Everyone can see this. There's a camera on us, can't you tell?
Oh, yeah, of course, at all times.
I'm in, not cargo shorts, but camouflage sweat shorts, because, you know, the army. Yeah, I already did exercise. But I also, I dress like a slob when I know that I don't have to go out,
right? But
like, you know, for podcasts,
but
come to my house.
You seemed like to me like you're fit though, right? Is that like a going to the gym?
That is true.
That's what I was saying.
Yeah, I go to, my wife and I are both into it, so we exercise almost every day.
I once had your...
Because we're desperate.
I once had your measurements. Like, it's a weird story. I know. Sorry, you've invited me to your home.
I'm very excited.
I've opened with, I've once had your measurements. But the reason that I once had your measurements was I was pitching a television show with KP Anderson, who you have worked with. And
wow.
We were trying to impress some people for me to host this show. And he was wondering whether I would fit into one of your really nice expensive suits for us to go and pitch this show.
Ah.
And so I got sent your measurements of, like, I said, well, send in the measurements and I'll see if, like, you know, I'll measure myself and see if I could
close,
like, sit into the suit. And, like, the figures did not add up for my body.
No.
Like, you were lighter than me, but bigger than me. Like, it was a real,
well,
I was like, this guy's doing better with what I have.
I'm heavier than you, though.
Well, I mean...
How much do you weigh now? I mean, maybe then I was less.
Yeah,
but
maybe. And I was different then too. But it was like, it was one of those things where I was going, ah, my body could be in a completely different order. Because it was about the same starting stuff.
Right.
You know, essentially we'd started with the same, but you were kind of the little pig who decided to, you know, build his house out of bricks, whereas I'd settled on paper or straw very early in the game.
How dare you? You look terrific other than your debilitating back injury.
So you're coming to Australia. So
yes.
Have you done stand-up in Australia before?
Yes. Twice.
Oh, okay. Nice. And
I did it at some theater in Sydney, and twice I did it at some theater. The first time I went, I did a show, and the second time I went, I did a show. So I've never been able to go because of... I was always shooting either Community or the very short-lived The Great Indoors or snuff films.
Yep. How are you still doing snuff films? Is that something you've kept your hand in just in case you have to go back?
It ends up costing me money.
Right.
So I've stepped back. It's really a labor of love more than anything.
A passion piece. So
yeah.
Talk me through you as a stand-up, because I'm very fascinated in, like, because you didn't start in the stand-up scene, did you?
No. I started doing improv, like tons of improv theater. Not even really sketch. So I did improv and then regular theater. A lot of that in Seattle. And then I got a job on a sketch comedy show in Seattle called Almost Live, which was a locally produced sketch comedy show that aired on the NBC affiliate half an hour before Saturday Night Live. So even though it was locally produced, it was very, very well watched. Thank God. I wasn't, because I didn't create it. I got hired. So I took no credit for that.
And were you young when that happened? What age are you when you suddenly get on this show?
22.
So that must be a pretty exciting time, right? 22. You're doing improv, like, in Seattle,
yeah.
And then suddenly you're on this, like, TV show that people are watching.
Yeah. That was pretty dramatic for me, a big change, because no one took me that seriously. My wife did, thank God. But no one took me that seriously as an actor. No one. I mean, I don't think people starting out usually, unless you have, you know, unless you're really successful or you have evidence to show that you're an actor. Most people are pretty like, oh, okay, actor, you'll be getting a real job. But yeah, then things changed. In Seattle, and then when I came here, I had no street credibility at all, and had to start all over again. It wasn't that it was starting. I mean, it was just like I had to. No one. It didn't matter that I was on some TV show in Seattle to them, which is ridiculous because it was a good TV show.
Well, I imagine that's what it's like, and, you know, certainly my experience coming here. But, like, for people who come here from a lot of places,
yeah,
that's
they go,
the case.
Well, wait a minute,
yeah.
I was doing great there. Yeah, so I took a job at a wine shop.
Oh, really?
As you evidenced by my...
I mean, I did... See, here's the thing. I'll give some people some behind the scenes. I was here before you were here, and I was shown into what
in
I...
In this room.
In this office,
He slept here yesterday. He snuck in. He stowed away.
In what I imagine is your office space, or
an
office space,
mm-hmm.
anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I trustingly left alone in here, I thought, for somebody who nobody but really knew coming over here.
Yeah.
I felt like, you know, there was... I was here
really
for
shows,
enough time.
It shows my generosity, and if you tried to use one of my swords, I have a very good way to stop you.
Which is what?
I can't reveal that on the podcast, because what if someone else comes here? Then they're going to know when they try to attack me.
No, it's a fair point. that was just a trap to see if you'd fall
into it.
That worked
out. It worked.
But there was, I did notice there was a lot of wine in here.
There's a lot of wine. Yeah, I like wine.
And there was a small part of me that wondered, like, just for the story, whether I should have put one of the, like, you know, bottles of wine in my bag. You know what I mean?
That would have been a good story. And I walked away. If it was a couple bottles, I would have known, and then you would have been, then I would have taken out the sword and let you have it big time.
And I did notice that there was a dog that came in at one stage, opened the door, mm-hmm. came in, had a sniff around, had a look at me.
The white dog or the brown dog?
It was the white dog.
Yeah.
Not a great guard dog is what I was going to say.
No. But
really was fine with the stranger just in the middle of the office.
Yes, but if the owner, me, comes home after 11, that white dog will wake up the entire neighborhood.
Right.
But as long as it's me. Because it lets everybody know in the house that dad is home. not an intruder, dad. Thanks a lot, dog.
Okay, so I want to know how stand-up came in, because there'd be some people, and there's some people in the world of stand-up who, mm-hmm. like, you know, once they start to have some success in other areas, if they're not driven by doing stand-up, then it might be something they even give away. You know, they might get into, you know, stand-up to be able to get into acting, to be able to get into a sketch show, and then they sort of let the stand-up drift away. What makes somebody who's, like, getting some success in other areas... When did stand-up come along, I guess, is what I'm asking.
Oh, stand-up came along in 2005. So, or two, yeah, 12 years ago is when I started doing it.
So where are you in your career 12 years
I'm
ago?
I'm in the first year of The Soup. It's 2004 is when it started, like June of 2004. And then went off for a while and then came back. But this agent of mine said... you can make a lot of money if you go out and host stand-up shows. And I went, great. I was like, it's a very spiritual reason I did it. But what it did was it got me on stage again and got me in front of people. And yeah, I was pretty bad. I didn't know what I was doing. I mean, obviously I'd done a lot of improv theater. So I did a lot of improv when I was hosting these shows. And then I kind of cobbled together an hour of jokes. And when I mean an hour, I mean 10 minutes that I could stretch into an hour. Now that I have done it 8,000 or 9,000 times, I'm decent.
Wait, what have you noticed is like changed in you? Because to keep doing it for that long... You know, it's not just, you know, that you can earn some money hosting some nights. You've got to have some genuine drive and passion.
Oh, I love it. No, I really do love
form
it.
Of it.
Yes.
So what is it about stand-up that you love differently to, like, you know, the other stuff that you're doing?
Well, I think it keeps me alive and younger because you use every part of your brain and soul. but doing an hour and a half, because I usually do two shows a night if I'm out, and that's like 3 hours of stage time, and that feeds the performer part of me. And the performer part is just below the waist. Right. But no, it really does. Like it's like working out, and it's like playing a sport for me. I know other guys. I like other guys drink and smoke on stage, and I can't do that. I would die. I see it as it's like a way to stay fresh. Well, I really enjoy it, so that helps. I mean, I like standing on stage and ridiculing people.
And is that, yeah, and where do you find those passions in your work come from? Because what outlet does it give you that, you know, the rest of your work doesn't? Like standing on stage and being able to tee off. I mean, you have this huge audience, you know, to come and see these shows.
Oh, great. Well, it keeps, like right now I don't have a show that I'm doing. I've got one I'm doing a guest star here and there, but until the next show comes around, I don't have anything, you know, scheduled. So that's one of the reasons why I love doing it, because it keeps me salty keeps me in it. So that's one of the reasons why I do it, because I was afflicted early on with wanting to be an actor and performer. So if we don't do it, we feel very insecure and feel like the world is ignoring us. So I also find it a way to Yeah, I mean, I've been able to see the country and I've been done in Australia, as I said, but and Canada, and so I like the people.
Yeah,
my wife would say that I'm an extreme extrovert. So, and she is an introvert. So she's like, it's a real fun time at a party with you.
Surely she just takes you to a party and then just releases you, right? And then she can just...
Oh, she has to drag me out because I'll talk all night.
Well, that's interesting though, because often some people who are exuberant performers, like people who've watched you, you know, you seem like that in your professional work. Sometimes those people, the other side of them is that they're not like that. You find that you're definitely the same.
I'm not as harsh in real life as I am on stage.
Okay.
Well,
that's good to know, because sometimes it's the other way around.
Yeah. I know performers that are very quiet and shy, but when they get on stage, they are electric and exploding, and then people that are very gregarious. So it's all over the map. I'm one of those people that will talk forever.
I'm interested in that, because like a lot of like you're going out on the road and touring. Like, I mean, you know, when I say the road, I mean, you're touring to, you know, these big festivals and going to places and doing a show, but it's still touring. You're still away from home. You're still on the road. You're still traveling a lot. Like that aspect of it is okay with you. You're an okay traveler. You're an okay person to be away from home.
No, I'm a good traveler. All those things. I like being in new cities and all that stuff. I do not like being away from my wife and kids. So that has changed. You know, when they were tiny, you know, they were not as, you know, now they're 9 and 12. So they're like, you know, they're people who are very well engaged with life and all that stuff. So I don't want to miss stuff. And I like hanging out with them. So that has changed. So like if someone says, hey, come do, like me going to Australia is not going to be, leaving the family for that long will be hard.
So 9 and 12 is like pretty interesting ages too, I imagine, because you're talking about people who are, you know, you're missing, when you're away, you're missing genuine parts of small human beings' life and development, you know?
Yes.
And so how do they go with, I mean, they've obviously grown up with it, but are they aware of dad, you know, that dad makes people laugh for a living, that dad's like a person who entertains people? What is it that they think you do? Do they know what you do?
No, they think I'm a firefighter.
Right.
Who just has to go to Montreal for a weekend for some fire. There's a four alarmer and they need to ship guys in. Oh, yeah, they're very well aware of what I do. Just like every kid knows what their dad does, I guess, unless they're in the CIA or something.
Well, I'm not sure that that is true, because like I grew up around a lot of people whose dads, you know, disappeared in the morning and came home at night, and it was kind of a mystery what they do.
Why isn't the dad telling them what they did?
Well, I mean, they can tell them, but with you, people can see what you do. Like there is actually, the case is that your kids can sit down
but
in front of YouTube.
But if your dad's a lawyer, you know that, well, dad's probably writing a contract law, just doing some contract law, right? I mean,
you could watch some episodes of Law and Order and get the gist of it, but you don't really know. It's a mystery when your dad goes away.
Yeah, I mean, they know what I do, but it's not like I disappear and then all of a sudden I reappear. I'm like, where were you? What was happening? I don't know. They know what I do. They always have. So I wouldn't keep it secret.
I feel like you've gone a little further with the question than I was going. I didn't imagine that you had like a second family or a second life.
Not yet.
It was just,
I was asking a bit more of family.
Do they have a great understanding of the fact that their dad is not only an actor, but a celebrity and someone who makes people laugh for a living? Like, you know, the sort of kind of complexity of what the actual job is, and the idea of like, you know, I mean, I could explain to, you know, a 9-year-old that, you know, somebody makes people laugh for a living, but I'm not sure that that 9-year-old would necessarily, you know or understand exactly what that means.
Oh, I think if you're 9, you understand quite a bit.
That's a good point. It was a long time ago.
Just think about when you were 9 and you knew way more stuff than your parents possibly let on. You know, they know that I work on TV and I was in Community. They rarely saw The Soup because they weren't that interested in that show, and it's not on and there's no way you can see it. So So they didn't, they knew I was doing something, like they've seen, like, I don't know, promotional stuff and posters and stuff. But yeah, they're aware. I mean, they go to a school that everyone's a performer. I mean,
yeah.
When you live in Hollywood or around this area,
it's the industry, so it's normal.
Yeah, there's some crazy statistic, like 70% of the people in Los Angeles County are somehow working in the entertainment business. I mean, the business is billions and billions, so it's huge. And there's actors and directors and producers.
I mean, it was a naive question asked by somebody who grew up in a farming community,
right?
And never met anyone in show business. Whereas it'd probably be more unusual if you kids were farmers going to your local school.
Yes.
They'd be like, "Who are these farmers?
We know
what's
no
their
farmers.
World."
Yeah. Oh, if there was a farmer, that would be terrific. But yes, they would be very confused. But everybody somehow works. It's rare when you meet someone who doesn't. When it's just like, "What do you do?" And you're just like, "Well, I'm just a." But even like a CPA would be somehow
attached to
definitely
the industry,
gonna be
right.
attached to the industry. Somehow.
Yeah. So it's like, yeah, I don't know how many teats a cow has, but I know where William Morris Endeavor is.
Yes.
So.
And you know that Detroit, like if you live in Detroit, somebody's making cars near you.
Right.
That is the industry. So
that is a very good point. So you said Seattle, but where did you come from? Did you go through Seattle or were you from...
Pretty much Seattle. Yeah. I was born in Rome, Italy. Thank you very much. Very exotic. I was born in Rome. We moved to Seattle, which my father, when he first got there, hated it and said, literally, he set out. He went from Rome to Seattle in 1976 or something, 75. And then we moved to New Jersey. And my dad was like, "Wow, I really do like Seattle." And then we went back to Seattle. And I love New Jersey, though. You get to trick or treat after school and snow and seasons. And then we, you know, since I was 8, I grew up there and left when I was 29.
Okay, so how old are you?
45.
Okay, so that means that you are in your kind of early sort of like 20s, late teens, early 20s, you are in Seattle at the kind of height of the Seattle like
yes.
music scene, right?
Yeah. Yeah. What is it? Nevermind was released when I was a freshman in college. I
okay. Think. Yeah.
Or
right.
the summer between high school and college.
That's so were you aware of that, like, going on in the place that you were from? Because, I mean, for a while, Seattle became the epicenter of, like, music in the entire world.
No, we were the center of the world for everything.
I mean, of course, but,
yeah.
but in particular.
But if you think about it, Seattle does control your life. They make the Boeing airplanes. Microsoft is there. Amazon and Starbucks. That's, I mean, pretty much you could... If Seattle hired an army and a navy and an air force, they could be their own very independent country. So yes, we were there when it was all hitting, and it was terrific. It was great to see music. And I used to go see Allison. I would see this band called the Young Fresh Fellows, and Alice in Chains opened for them. And it was those were the days. I remember. I was at a bumper shoot concert and some band canceled and Soundgarden was like, "Yeah, we'll do it." And Soundgarden showed up that day and was like, it was terrific. It was a good time. It was Seattle exploded. And I always grew up going, "Well, this is what happens when you live anywhere. Your city just becomes super popular and tons of money gets poured into it." And then I had friends who were like, "I'm from Pittsburgh." And I was like, "Ooh, all right, I see.
But it must be exciting, like to be, I mean, as you said, if it's what you, all you've known, you don't necessarily get the outside opinion of being there in the middle of it. But to be in the middle of something taking off, in the middle of something exploding, like it must be a very kind
it was
of
very
intoxicating
cool.
experience.
There were so many rock clubs popping up and so many outdoor festivals, and even in the rain they would have them, and there was so much, there was music everywhere.
Did you feel like
everywhere.
It was a particularly creative city at that time? Like, was there a sense about Seattle then that
Yeah, there's
it was?
A real defensiveness that Seattle has because we were always considered the, not only the left coast of America, but we were up in the corner. We were even accused of being slightly communist in the 50s. And no, we just always thought we were in this... We literally, they advertise the state as the other Washington and not Washington, D.C. I remember seeing promotional ads for that stuff. And so we like big bands also would not come to Seattle. U2 would go from San Francisco to Vancouver and play BC Place, and not, they wouldn't play the Kingdome or the Tacoma Dome. And then all the big bands, and it was overnight, they all were coming. And I was like, oh, this is what happens. Yeah, your city just grows. But so we always felt like we had a distinct, unique person. The city was definitely its own self. And it was a time when it was different than LA because everyone was so many people were moving to Seattle. And I just thought, well, this is what happens too. Everyone just come, you know, it just, as your city move, as it ages, people just show up, and everyone was moving there, and it was terrific.
Yeah, I've spent a little bit of time in Seattle because I get booked for the clubs there quite regularly because Seattle is full of Australians, and
it
so
is?
They ah oh, so
I
Microsoft.
I thought that was Vancouver.
Oh yeah, right. Also Vancouver. Yeah, Vancouver. If you're a ski instructor,
I went to Whistler and I was like, so great to be here in Australia.
And the other one, yeah, so in Seattle, if you're better with computers than skiing.
Wow.
So Microsoft, a lot of Australians work for Microsoft. Yeah, there's certain bizarre places around America that if where I tour to, where suddenly you're just like, hang on, why is there like 90 Australians at this show?
LA is one of those places. Yeah.
Well, that's true. There was a point. The Australian dollar now is kind of like 73 cents or something to the American dollar.
Yes,
right?
I'm excited to spend money there.
But there was a point when I first came here 8 or 9 years ago, where the Australian dollar was like $1.10 to the American dollar. And it was like America was a third world country. And there was Australians just coming here like we were in Bali in Indonesia, like just throwing money. Because everything's cheaper here already. And then our dollar was worth all this money. And everyone was like, this is just the best, like getting to LA and making it rain. And then eventually...
Why are cars more expensive there? It doesn't make any sense.
Well, it's from the old days when you had to get them there.
I feel like you can get things anywhere you want quick.
Well, firstly, you had to get them there. But the other thing was...
Look, it takes a lot longer to get from Korea to America than it does to get from Korea to Australia. So you could ship Kias there anytime.
Well, see, here's the other thing, John, is you've identified something, which is that we have incredibly high tariffs on cars from other countries because it was protecting the Australian automobile industry. But here's what has happened in the last 5 years. The Australian automobile industry has completely gone out of business because it's an unsustainable industry anyway. But guess what we haven't done? Got rid of those taxes on the cars from overseas.
Dang.
Because government is always in your favor.
Wow. That sucks for you guys. Yeah. Remind me not to buy a car there.
Don't buy a car while you're there. That would be...
Although the dollar
difference would even it out.
It would make it about the same.
Yeah, about the same. That's right.
So cars are what, 20% more? 25% more there?
That's about right.
Oh, that sucks.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Oh, no. It's one of those things where people come to America and they just go, hang on, what? I can do what? Hang on, what? Hang on, what?
I can buy that?
Right.
That's great.
Yeah, it's very, like, it's. I've heard of so many people who come over here and end up buying a car, which is just not a thing you should normally buy on your holidays.
No.
Like, you know.
But you're like, it's because I can.
You know, it's like a car is cheap when you can impulse buy on a holiday and know that getting it shipped to Australia, getting it changed over so the steering wheel's on the other side of the car is still cheaper than buying that same car in Australia.
That doesn't seem possible, but all right. Yeah. Jeez Louise.
What do you do when you're on tour? I'm just interested because I know you're coming to Australia and you've got, you know, shows down there and, you know, I want people to come out and see the shows. What is your vibe when you're on tour? Are you a... Like, you know, Justin Bieber was down there recently.
Oh, yeah, we're very similar.
And, you know, it's all late night, you know, nightclub appearances and, you know, girls being invited back to his, you know, all that
sort
of
stuff. I'm old.
How do you roll?
People are not asking me to go to nightclubs. I'm old. And so he can do a show and then stay out till 7 in the morning.
Right.
I am old and I got to get to bed. And,
like, is that right? Is it? Can you sleep straight after a show? You don't
have
that.
No, I have to stay up for a couple hours. But no, I just usually go to dinner. It's very, very exciting.
Yeah. No. I mean,
I literally will go on, I don't know, we have, you know, I go on Yelp and go like, what's open late at night that's good? It's not that I will wake up hopefully at a reasonable time so I can go see the city.
During the day, mm-hmm. Are you a walk around, drive around? Are you looking to see, like, go to a museum?
Usually exercise, like you.
What are you doing? Yep.
But I don't to go like, well, I should go deep sea fishing now that I have 4 hours off. Right. I don't have time for that. I usually keep it pretty mellow and go like, oh, I hear this is a good coffee shop.
Right.
And maybe I'll see a movie, but that actually rarely happens too.
If you were going to see a movie, like, what's the sort of thing that's going to get you to the cinema? What's the sort of movie?
Oh, well, I just saw Dunkirk on Saturday, and I had two shows that night, and that's a wonderful, fun film
to get you ready for some.
Yeah,
comedy?
It's just to make it does make you go, man. I gotta stop worrying about stuff. this guy's had way bigger problems.
Do you think that's what Christopher Nolan was going for? He's like, you know what, guys? The feeling I want at the end of this is that people just walk away from the cinema and go,
yeah.
Hey, you know what? My life's fine.
Things aren't so bad. I shouldn't worry about whether I, double parked in that mall shopping mall, you know, yeah. Shopping mall parking lot.
I would love if Christopher Nolan came out, because he's quite a, I love his films, by the way, but he's quite a, you know, serious. Yeah, you know, man, but it'd be great if you were just like, you know, in an interview going, well, really, you know, we constructed the whole thing just to say, don't sweat the small stuff, you know?
Yeah, guys, well, there's a lot of movies that should make people feel low. Any World War movie or any war movie
essentially
should make you go, I'm doing all right.
To be honest, any movie that is based on a true story.
Yeah.
Pretty much any movie based on a true story. Because to be based on a true story and made into a movie, something fucked up happened to them.
Yeah. Lone Survivor. That's a fun one. That'll make you go, oh, I should not worry so much about this paint peeling. I'll get to it at some point. I feel like Christopher Nolan puts a lot of humor in his movies. Dunkirk was not, you know, there wasn't a ton of jokes in that, but a lot of the Batman has good humor in it.
What is the stupidest thing you worry about? Like, you know, is there like a little... I had this like cupboard at my house for like, I would say, a year. And it needed to be fixed, but it needed to be fixed in a way that involved one more thing that I had around the house. So like, you know, like I can fix something if a screw's out of it or if it like nail needs to be hammered in, that sort of thing.
Right.
But this had a hinge thing. I was going to have to go to a hardware store. I was going to have to just do a little bit more effort. And so for a year, this like cupboard just kind of hung like half on its hinge. And I would constantly just be thinking about this cupboard where eventually it was just very easy to get fixed and get done. Do you have things like that? Is there something that is on your
plate? You need to go see Dunkirk now. No. Because that doesn't sound like... That just sounds like... I don't know. You've got other things to do.
At the start, it was other things to do. But after a while, it becomes symbolic of the fact that I can't fix things in my life. Do you know what I mean? Like, after a while...
You really think it's a symbol?
Well, I mean, again...
That's your problem. You're reading too much into shit.
So you're not that sort of person, clearly. You're not like a worrier or...
Oh, I definitely worry about stuff. I'm worried about, like, what am I going to do next?
Right.
How are my kids going to do? How are they? You know, I don't like, I worry that I don't get enough sleep. There's that.
How much do you sleep a night?
I went to bed at 1 last night and got up at 6:30.
Yeah, you're not getting enough sleep, man.
I need to stay in bed till like 8 if I can. But my kids are up, so.
I feel like you need to go to bed earlier. I feel like
it's
to bed at 1 thing. What are you doing until 1 o'clock?
Last night I was catching up on a bunch of stuff, and then I meant to watch Game of Thrones to finally catch up, but I played Battlefield 1 with my friend Boyd,
okay.
Which is an extraordinary video game. Again, those guys had it really rough in World War One, and they did not respawn. No, I worry. I try to manage my, like, if I feel like, oh, you're worrying about something weird.
Right.
Then I'm like, what are we talking about? Like when I had kids, I definitely, like, when I get on planes, I was like, oh, I'm a dad now. It's like being on it's obviously safer than a motorcycle, but I was like, oh, this could go down and then my children will be fatherless. So then I started going like, all right, well, clearly, planes are pretty damn safe. And all these people seem pretty all right with it that are on the plane with me, so I probably shouldn't worry about that.
Yeah, I must have, like, I mean, that's the thing, right? The children thing is obviously the thing that changes everybody's mind about those. Yeah. But then eventually you just have to go.
Yeah, I bought an electric skateboard and I was like, wait a minute, what if I fly off this thing and snap my femur? I'm like, well, I might as well just give it a try.
So hang on, what, the electric skateboard, is this like a to get around the sort of neighborhood electric skateboard?
So when the Great Indoors was on, it was literally across the river, and I mean literally, and the river is right there, and there's a little footbridge, and I literally, and I'm going to say it because it literally true, it was faster for me to skateboard than it was for me to drive.
Right.
And hey, we're saving the environment. So I would skateboard, so as a gift to myself for getting the show, you know, for having the show on the air, I bought an electric skateboard, and now the show's canceled. So I guess I have to, find another. I mean, it's been obviously a very good luck charm. It's been great.
So, when you said you like sometimes worry about what you're going to do next, those sort of things, like it'd be interesting for people to hear that, I think, because some people would imagine that your career, you know, just, you know, is whatever you want it to be, you know.
Wow. Those, like, people are misinformed.
Right. But people imagine that, I imagine, about a lot of people who would have that same story. Like, I mean, you know, I have actor friends who've been in successful shows, but you know what it's like on the bottom couple of rungs. It doesn't matter that you're in a successful show. It doesn't mean that you...
Are you saying
still...
I'm in the bottom couple of rungs? Is that what you're saying?
No, that wasn't
what
I was saying.
That's what he just said, folks.
I was starting
exactly
with those
what he
rungs,
said.
And then I was going to build up to the top
couple I think
rungs.
Almost,
you know,
every...
I mean?
I would say, unless you're ultra confident and you've got, I don't know, you're Bill... you're someone like, I don't know, Tom Cruise or something, where... it's going to be okay if you don't ever work again. But he obviously is a person that loves working, but I love working, and I want to make sure that next thing I work on is decent. So.
Is there like a thing that you haven't got to do yet that really is something that you would really love to do? Like, is there some sort of burden? Because you've written books, you've hosted TV you've acted, you've, like, obviously you've improvised, you're doing stand-up. In the gamut of, like, show business and, like, what it is that you can do with your skills, what's been the most exciting thing to do with them? Like, what have you enjoyed the most where you go in, this is, like, of all the things that I've got to do using the skills that I have, this is what I've found, you know, the most fun or the most exciting, the most exhilarating, or maybe even just the most... you know, where you go, this best uses all the skills that I have.
I would, in my mind, none of the above, because I'm in a constant state of worrying whether what I'm doing is any good. There are things when I'm doing it, I'm like, oh, this is great. And that has happened a number of times. But it's not like, oh, this is the thing. This is the exact thing that I... I've had a number of moments in doing different things where I was very like, oh, look at this. We're on a little mountain peak here and I can kind of enjoy. But there was moments when I was hosting The Soup where I was like, that was one of the best written jokes I've ever said out loud. Written, not by me, but when I was in that movie with Eric Bana, I had such a good time. My dog's trying to get in.
He'll stay for about 2 seconds. Hi.
We can do that. Yeah, there'll be a little dog coming in now, just doing a little lap of the room. Hello. Hello.
Hi.
Hello. How are you? Hello.
That's Cowboy.
Cowboy. Hello, Cowboy. Hello, Cowboy. Look at you. You're a cutie, aren't you? This is good. This is good for the people. Yeah. Ordinarily, when we do this podcast at home, my dogs will come in and be on the podcast. So really, it's good to have... hang on. There we go. Trying to get away, but it's all right. Come on in. Now you're part of it. There you go. See? Yeah, come in. It's all right. Yeah, good. Cowboy. Who was Cowboy named after? Named by, sorry.
Is that named by some
choice?
Animal trainer.
Oh, okay, all right.
I got Cowboy on the set.
Is Cowboy showbiz?
Showbiz puppy, but not trained.
Right.
Cowboy was in a scene,
uh-huh.
And I went, I am going home with that dog, no matter how much he costs. And $75,000 later, he was mine. Right?
No,
and I brought him home. My wife was like, what the hell? And my wife is allergic to fur. So we have a dog with hair, the white dog, and this one has fur. So there's fur everyone. She's like, thanks a lot. But now she loves him.
So
really, and the dog loves her way more than me.
And has Cowboy worked again since, or has Cowboy...
I put him in some promotional videos that
I've done. Do you get the feeling that Cowboy misses the set and the scene?
Yeah, or? Yeah. He's definitely jonesing to get back on TV.
Right, yeah.
Probably something on Netflix, something streaming. He wants to,
Oh, he wants to stretch?
Yeah, yeah. He wants, that's he's such a big fan of film there, right? And stuff. But
is there any sort of like role that he is particularly looking for? Is there?
Yes,
like...
he would like to play a Labradoodle.
Oh, right.
Which is very a big stretch for a pug.
I mean, it is.
Yeah. Right, guy?
I mean, I know there's been a lot of lobbying in the Labradoodle community that only Labradoodles play Labradoodles, though, and that it would be offensive for a pug to play Labradoodle.
I agree.
Right?
But you know, he definitely doesn't care.
He wants
a shot. He understands it's gonna be controversial.
And he's pro Labradoodle, like for the.
Oh yeah, he wants to tell their story because they weren't really around until just a few years ago.
It's a good point, right?
Right, doggy. He's very interested in your dog smell.
Yeah, exactly. It's because my bag smells like my dog's probably.
But I remember being on the set.
My bag smells like weed. That'll be one of the two. Does he like other dogs or weed? Because it's the only two things.
I don't think he's ever had weed. Maybe he's trying to get in, so he must love it.
Whatever's going on, he's really, really.
Give him an eighth. He'd love that.
You all right, buddy? You all right? Yeah, you can really smell my animals.
All right, Doug. Go to your question. I mean, there he goes. Like when I was on the set of Community, I was like, oh, this is awesome. This is really well written and really well told, and the cast is really good.
So you could tell, right?
Because I could tell on that. I mean,
it's one of those shows where, like, I mean, people who listen to this podcast know this about me, which is that I'm not a really big, I find that comedy. I like my comedy to be very realistic ordinarily, reason. And Community was certainly not that at all. It is one of my favorite comedy shows of all time. It was just one of those things where you always, much like watching an episode of The Simpsons or whatever, where you would go, or like, you know, it reminded me a bit of the animated shows that I love. You know, you would just say there would be something in this, like in this episode, in this show today, that I will just think, well, that was worth having watched all of it regardless. Like you'd never walk away from an episode of that and think, well, there wasn't something in that that had just this sparkle of like idiotic genius or actual genius. Like, I mean, there was an awareness of that while it was, you were doing it as well.
Well, we knew the show was well written. We knew that just at the base when we first started, we're like, this is, I read the script and I was like, oh, this is great. I know I can, I wish I could do this. And Dan Harmon took pity on me and allowed me to do it. That I knew. So, and then as it started getting, as it moved along and Dan's imagination went wild, we all felt like I knew what I was doing. I was like, it's going to be very hard to make a show like this again. And NBC certainly was not, we're not fans of it. We're constantly like, well, this is probably it. So I'm like, okay. And then they'd pick us up because something else would fail. And so we got 5 years out of them and 1 year out of Yahoo.
Yeah, I think it's one of those shows that I can imagine when you had it, you would not know what you had.
The first couple of seasons were like, this is pretty crazy and pretty great. And it was staying on and was rating. And so that was one of those things where you're like, wow, it's working. And you never really, you take it for granted on the show that if I was on a bunch of shows that failed, then I probably would have appreciated. But it was the third pilot I did. And it was like, oh, well, this makes sense. they 30% of the time it gets on. That seems about right.
Yeah, this is your version of, oh, you live in a city and it becomes the most popular city in the world.
Right.
You're like, this is how it works.
Yeah.
I was in Seattle. It became the epicenter of all music and culture in the entire world.
Yeah.
Then I moved here and everything I touch turns to gold. How's your life?
That's how it goes. I knew Seattle was popular when I went to Italy in 90. I went there in 94.
Was that first visit back? Was that first visit?
That was first visit back since I was a kid. Yeah. I've been there a few times since because my aunt and uncle still live there. Yeah. But Italians were wearing flannel shirts.
Right.
And I was like, this is not what I expected. I thought they'd be all slick. And my cousin who lives there, he was like, yeah, this is that. That's the Seattle look. Yeah. And I was like, jeez. They'd be like super nice jeans, dress shoes, curled up cuffs, and then like a really nice white t-shirt, and then a perfect, like very well put together plaid shirt. And I was like, that is not something I expected.
There's something quite amazing about seeing the particularly if you're into some sort of band or whatever, that like, you know, be it The Cure or something that comes with a sort of a uniform of sorts. Because
yes.
what you find is if you see that band wherever you are in the world, you get to see, you know, if you go and see The Cure in Japan, like it's just Japanese versions of the same people who go
right.
and see The Cure in, you
yep.
know.
But you could make, like, but Seattle was the opposite. It was the reaction to glam metal. So it's ironic that a person walking on stage wearing jeans and a t-shirt became like, wow, that's innovative.
Yeah, that's the look.
That's...
Because your look
crazy.
Wasn't a look. That's now a look.
Yes, it was the opposite of it was the reaction of just do nothing. And that became the thing. The glam rock guys, they bought a lot less lipstick.
I mean, I always, like, have you ever been a get dressed up? Are you a fancy dress? Like, are you a person who enjoys a fancy dress party? Are you a person who enjoys getting costumed up in, like, an elaborate sort of way? Because I imagine, like, that was the kind of incredible... dichotomy of bands of that sort of era, you know, your Motley Crue's, your Guns N' Roses, these hardcore bands that were kind of living this like image of being, you know, hardcore on the edge, and were in a lot of ways those things, but at the same time were spending like an hour before the gig putting their makeup on and like teasing their hair. Like,
yeah, it was crazy because obviously bands like Black Sabbath and Led Zeppelin, and they also were the opposite reaction to the, you know, the very put together bands of the 60s. So and then it swung the other direction. And but do I like to get dressed up? Not like Motley Crue.
Yeah, but not like if someone said we're throwing a fancy dress party, would you say,
oh, sure,
I'm not,
yeah,
go,
I'm not one of those I know people that they try very hard in their effort to look casual and slovenly. They are, it's just, if you're invited to a fancy party and you know it's a fancy party and you choose not to show up to a fancy party in fancy clothes or something that looks close enough to it, that is a conscious effort that, and you, no matter how much like, oh, this is me, you know, I'm like, nope, nope, it would not be that hard for you to put on a suit. So I dress appropriately. I liked dressing up. I liked getting free suits and stuff when I worked on the soup. That was good because that was really nice. I liked wearing nice clothes on that, but I would only wear it once, for a few hours each, once a week to shoot the show. And then, you know, then as you can see, I'm dressed like I've escaped, I don't know, a Big Five Sporting Goods.
So if you're going to go out and eat, like what's the, like I always like to know what people, you know, sort
eat?
Of last meal sort of.
Oh,
things.
Before I'm,
you know,
executed?
Yeah, before you're executed for crimes that we will find out about later on, I assume.
Oh, this is going to be a cheat, but probably my mom's spaghetti carbonara.
Oh, really?
That's good. I love... I don't know. It would for my last meal, if I were on death row, it would be a combination of Japanese food.
I mean, here's the thing I'm going to say to you. It might just be... is your mother still with us?
Not here. Yes,
yeah,
she lives
but like
in Seattle.
But in case you need to, like, if you're being executed and you ask for your mum's, like, you know, spaghetti, she's still available to make it.
Absolutely.
Okay. I feel just like it'd be, like, I feel like she'll already be going through a really hard week, and I just feel like getting her to have to cook as well.
I think
if she's
distracted,
you'd be good for her.
It'd be
better
good.
For her.
Distracted.
Take her mind off it.
Yeah. They're definitely going to know what the contents of my stomach are okay. after the autopsy. But but I don't. It's that's hard to say. I mean, I would.
Well, what's your food if you like?
Maybe I would go to the French Laundry or something right. before I get executed.
Okay, so like do it properly. Yeah. Is what you're saying.
Yeah, that'd be good.
Are you a person who, like, say, for example, you're going to Sydney, there's some of the best restaurants in the world, you know, in Sydney. Are you the sort of person who will go...
Yeah, but you guys put mayonnaise on your lobster, which is insane. That doesn't make any sense at all.
Is that some of the relatable material that you're going to be doing?
Probably. I just couldn't believe it. An American friend said, go to this place, I don't know where, in not Bondi Beach, some beach you had to take a ferry to, and he was like, just... They're going to order the lobster and just make sure they will do not put mayonnaise on it. And I was like, okay. And I literally was like, you didn't put that because they were taking a while. I was like, you didn't put mayonnaise on it. And the person ran back in a panic and they had to redo it. If I'm there, I definitely, last time I was there, I looked at was all the Eater Sydney. And I looked at all the, you know, I write all the articles about eating in Sydney and I went to a couple of amazing places.
What about, do you need to do anything touristy? Do you need to climb
the bridge?
Yeah.
No.
Cause I'll offer you, they'll try to get you up on that bridge.
I've already done it. The first time I went.
Nah, and did you think it was worth it?
It was okay.
Yeah.
Because I was like, those office buildings are a lot taller.
The hotel you were staying in was probably taller, right?
Yeah, but I would run. So I would jog on that bridge. So that was...
Right. Oh, yeah, that's
nice.
I'd
see the people all... Okay. No, there's nothing... There was... Now, Sydney, I've been there twice. So I've seen a lot of... I don't know.
But you didn't need to go and see a koala or...
The first time when I was on E, they had me running around doing all that.
Right, right.
It was fun. It was fun. And having... touching a koala bear and holding it was... I was like, well, this is something I've never done.
When you say you're on E also, you mean like on the television network?
On the E network, yes.
Yeah, inviting you out to Australia, dropping Molly and then hugging koalas.
Yeah, I didn't do that. But the koalas, I'm sure, would have been amenable to that.
Oh, they would have been into it. Riddled with chlamydia, but...
But you got, I don't do the, I don't gamble as much as you guys, so...
So gambling is a really big... part of the Australian culture, only behind Singapore, our per capita gambling in the entire
world. It's impressive.
Is it though? Isn't it?
No, it's impressive the same way, you know,
as like someone
20 car pile up is.
Right.
it's amazing.
It's everywhere, right?
Yeah, how you guys are like, it's fine. Fine. Do it.
It's not fine though, is it?
I like it. Like during sporting events, you're getting the odds. That's amazing.
Yeah, there's no way that'll go wrong at any stage.
Yeah, there's no one losing all their money and penniless and not providing for their families.
No, and there's no way that these results will ever be corrupted by the system that's built around it.
that's something distinct. But
are you a sports fan? Are you
very much?
Okay, so what sort of sports are you into? What's like your passion?
I like American NFL football and basketball.
Do you follow Seattle in the?
Well, of course.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, I don't know. I'm asking you questions.
No, I like NBA basketball. Yeah. I like baseball too. I mean, I follow.
Were you a sporty kid? Did you play?
Of course,
sports?
I was. My
friend. I mean, you look very sporty now, but you might have blossomed into this person I see before me.
No, I was larger when I was younger.
You hang out, as in not taller though, right?
I was possible. Taller. In America, we shrink at least 5 inches during our lifespans.
Okay, right. Interesting.
It's really crazy.
Yeah, okay. I mean, we're from a different hemisphere.
I was 6'9" when I was 18.
Like Benjamin Button, but with height.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Crazy. Okay. No, I was a huge sports fan and played tons of sports, and I was that's all I did. That and acting.
Where did the sports dream end? If there was was there a sports dream?
No.
Was there a chance that at any stage you were gonna, take any of those things? If you were gonna take one of them, none of them?
No. I mean, I knew that I was good at sports to a point.
Right.
But I played college football badly. And the guys who were ahead of me and who were playing in the games were so much better than me.
Right.
That I knew. I mean, I am an insanely competitive person to a point of fault. But I knew. I was like that. Those guys are much better than me, and I'm never. There's nothing I can do to make myself as good as them. They're just going to be faster and stronger.
All right.
And I was pretty fast and strong, but not on that level. Not even in the same. Not even the same atmosphere. You know, nothing.
If there's somebody in the world of professional sports that you could change places with, like who would be your ideal? You know what I mean? If you go, I can have that guy's life.
I thought you, their athletic ability or their life?
Well, I mean, answer both. Give us the answer. It may well be the same answer for both, but tell me whose athletic ability.
Oh, I would want like Muhammad Ali's athletic ability, yeah. But I wouldn't want
his life.
His sad. Having.
Yeah. So you'd like Muhammad Ali?
Very difficult. I love Muhammad. I mean, right. But that would be a very difficult.
Yeah.
Difficult
so you want the peak of his career, but you want like the life of Tom Brady or whatever.
Where I'm in hyperbolic chambers or whatever. I don't know Tom. I don't know what his day to day is like.
I feel like he has like it feels like his life's going pretty well. Right?
No. Who knows?
I mean, who knows?
There could be a lot of maybe just a lot of tension. I don't know. That's the hard. Like I would like
to be a good time at home. You're right.
Yeah. I mean,
I'm making assumptions.
I don't know who that would be. Where it's like he led the perfect life. Everything was great.
All right. Well, we can't have that.
I'll take athletic ability.
But you'll take Ali's.
Because you're not going to be like, oh, I want to have Tiger Woods' life because. You know, things got rough for a while.
Well, again, up to a point, I suppose.
Yeah.
So. Like this, I guess, like the Ali thing. The early years are better.
I'll take
than
Muhammad
the
Ali's
years.
Skill. That's
yeah,
great.
Right. Plus, you know, the ability to drop a classic one-liner. Like, it's not like you have to give up funny to be Ali. You know, the great thing about Ali is, you know.
This is some sort of weird fantasy world that we're in right now where we're able to extract people's skills from them and but yet keep it who we are.
I mean, yeah.
That's what you're saying.
I mean, right. Well, it's what people call a hypothetical scenario.
Right. I mean,
so what we're basically doing very, is we're hypothesizing
it's wonderfully
about,
hypothetical.
That's... So yeah, you know, sorry, I'm not. If I had in some way led you to believe that I could make this happen, then I'm absolutely
now
sorry about
I'm
that, but,
disappointed.
Yeah, sorry. No. This was purely just a
dang it
hypothetical thought experiment that I thought
dang
might be
it
a fun way to finish on.
Okay. Sad.
All right, I'm going to give you a second shot at it now, based on
another hypothetical,
based on
right
the premise. But again, just for the record, I can't actually make this happen.
Okay.
All right. Cool. Which comedian's powers, skills would you like? Like in the same way as you know, who out there do you admire that you watch when you watch?
That I would like to.
Do you go
extract their talent?
If I could have those skills,
I'm not going to take away what they've built for themselves.
No, I'm literally saying if you can have, in the same way as you could have the athletic skills of Muhammad Ali.
All right, so I've got the athletic skills of Muhammad Ali.
The comedic skills of...
Like Richard Pryor. That would be really great.
Yeah, all right.
So this person, who is this?
I mean, again, though, how is the... Even if you have the comedic skills of Richard Pryor, I'm not sure you have the, you know, struggles that Richard Pryor had. So
I grew up in a brothel. Okay. Everyone knows it. Look, I grew up watching Bill Cosby. I listened to his records backwards and forwards. That is a thing that is very dubious to say out loud right now. Steve Martin, I followed like nobody's business. Richard Pryor. I watched Monty Python endlessly. I watched Mel Brooks endlessly. My Woody Allen movies. I don't want to take over any of those people's lives. Not yet.
Again, you're not. You don't have to.
I would like to take over the life of a very young comedian when I'm very old, like when they're six. Maybe like 15, and then, you know, occupy their body. I would feel bad for them because then, anyway.
Right. Because
we can work out the science later.
Yeah, we'll work out the science later when you get old enough. All right, Joel, let's talk one more time because we should finish up. But this.
How long have we been talking?
We've been talking for the amount that this podcast goes, which is 50, well, I mean, an hour.
And
it's,
how long?
It's going to go for an hour, and we're at 55 minutes now. So this is the thank you. Bit,
oh,
then,
hold on. Oh, hang make on, sure everything's. All right.
Well, we're just finishing, really. That's all.
No worries. Cash 350.
Yep, sorry. So, anyway, Sydney shows. What can we tell people?
Sydney.
Well, Australia shows.
Oh, here comes the dog.
All over Australia shows. Hello. 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 What's your name? Hello.
That's Harry.
Oh, that's
Harry the
Harry
dog.
Hello,
and
Harry.
There's Cowboy again.
Cowboy's coming.
What can you expect?
Yeah.
As I've said to different radio show hosts and podcast hosts, a lot of pyrotechnics.
A lot of pyrotechnics?
Like a lot of feathered hair. It's like a Bon Jovi concert.
Okay, yeah, sure. Nice.
Yeah. No, it's not.
It's not
probably
like
going to be me in a microphone. What can you expect? Hopefully,
I mean, I don't really.
It will be the funniest hour and 15 minutes of your life.
I mean, that's all really I was getting to.
That
I
hopefully, actually, if you don't like it, right. Please don't tell anyone.
I mean, look,
if you did like it, please tell me.
Guys, here's basically what's really going on here is like, you know who this is. If you've listened to this podcast, you probably already like Joel. All this, the whole purpose of this podcast is this bit of it right now, which is to say, come and see the shows, guys.
Yes.
Just come and see the show.
Come and see them. And
this
it will be
why
this...
it is happening.
Yes. I should have promoted the shows throughout the podcast, but you had very thoughtful questions.
I constantly asked you about stand up and the shows. So, like, I mean, you know, this is also the bit where we will say it again.
No.
Come and see them. That'll be great, right?
Come and see the shows. And if you'd like, buy 10 or 11 tickets at a time for yourself. Okay. You need a chair for your purse.
Don't tell people to do that. Tell people
I can tell people whatever I want.
It's your show. But
how many people hear this podcast?
Like thousands.
Thousands.
Maybe like 50,000.
You're just making stuff up now.
Well, I was trying to work out in my head what sort of bump I'd get from having you on.
Wow.
So,
well, I'm sorry.
I gave you a 10,000 bump.
An
average episode will get somewhere between 30 and 40. But I'm hoping that I might get a 10,000
bump. No one really believes you. You know that.
You. So I'm going to say, like.
Why don't we just go with 400,000?
Well, because I don't want to lie to people. I want to slightly...
You never know. There might
I want to round up in my favor, which is what I did. But I don't want to lie blatantly.
This will be the bump you're looking for. So,
well, maybe there is 400,000 listening to this. And if you knew
this... Yeah, there's probably a million.
Well, to the million... That is a good point, actually. To the... Well, into the 900 and, 96,000 or whatever who don't normally listen... Come back next week.
All right.
It'll be great.
All right.
Go and see Joel's shows. They're going to
go and see the shows. Also, the ones in New Zealand.
Oh, New Zealand as well.
I know that.
We don't have as many listeners in New Zealand.
Though. Oh, all right. Well, then.
Are they not selling as well?
What?
You probably need to get on a New Zealand
Well, no.
Podcast.
I wanted to include them in the Australian show promotion.
Well, we're not the same, though. We're not the same.
Oh, yeah. You
same.
Guys sound exactly the same, and you look the same.
We don't,
so you
actually.
Must be.
That's really racist.
Yeah, you must be. How is it racist? What race am I insulting?
The Australian and New Zealand race.
Oh, I didn't realize it was a race.
Duh. Australasians.
Okay. All right, I see. Australians.
No, Australasians. And don't you be coming down here pretending like we're not real people.
At no point did I say that.
Well, that's what I heard.
I know that you all have. I know you have tails and horns down there. So, yeah.
Oh, don't be like that. That's unfortunate. That's actually.
Hey, look, everyone knows it's a fact.
That's just a gambling game you can play, tails and horns.
Oh, no wonder you gamble so much. You guys are gargoyles.
John McHale, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me.